educators, welcome to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM and online. Each week at this time, I bring you new ideas about education from leading practitioners and thinkers on the topic from Ireland and around the world. My name is Sean Delaney, and a treasure trove of over 300 previous episodes can be downloaded or listened to at seandelaney.com/podcasts. My guest today is an expert on the Transformation Society, and he knows all about transformation in his own professional life. Ray Gallen was a journalist, producer, and manager in public radio in the United States. He worked in some large technical industries with companies like IBM and General Electric Healthcare. Today, he gives workshops to organizations about digital transformation, and he's the co-chair of the primary and pre-primary research and development community of the Association for Teacher Education in Europe, the ATEE. It was at the 2018 annual conference of the association that I met up with Ray Gallen, where we discussed the implications of the digital society for education and much more. I began our conversation by asking Ray why he was interested enough in teacher education to be attending the annual conference of the ATEE.
I'm very interested in the transformation of society, and I actually run a company called the Transformation Society, which is put as an alternative to the Information Society, which I see is based on accumulation of information. In other words, another accumulation model. Just like accumulation of money or accumulation of goods, etc. And I think we need a different model, hence transformation. I'm interested in teacher education in that context because there's a multiplier factor. You convince one teacher educator, they train 30 teachers a year who go out and train anywhere between 20 and 30 students a year. So the notion that you work upstream and hopefully some of it trickles down, to use a current phrase, is part of what I'm interested in.
How would you describe the goals of your company?
One of them is, of course, to keep us fed. But we're consultants, and we're consultants who have a certain social consciousness, a certain social purpose. So I would say it's to help organizations and individuals learn to live with the digital transformation that is happening today, and to socialize it and to humanize it so that it actually serves people and not the other way around.
So who might avail of your services then?
Well, it could be anybody. It could be people in industry, in government, could be NGOs, and certainly educators, associations, etc. And we work with people in all those categories.
Okay, so suppose I'm running a business, say I'm making widgets or I'm, you know, in the food industry. What kind of questions would you be asking me that would be important to see how I might respond to the changes in society?
Well, there are a number of ways that I might go at it. I might ask you, are you using your employees in a way that maximizes their talents, you know, that gets the most out of what they do best, what they know best, etc.? I would also ask, what is the role that information plays in your company? Are you providing your customers with the information they need? Are you providing your employees with the information they need? You as a director, do you have the information that you need to do your job properly? And if not, how do you get it? And how do you make sure that everybody has access to the information they need? You know, there's for centuries, there's been an expression, knowledge is power. And for most of history, that's meant whoever could hoard the most knowledge and keep it secret had power. Today, I believe it's just the opposite. Knowledge is still power, but it's in sharing it that you have power. So the person who becomes known as the go-to source for information about one or another subject is somebody who has, you might say power, or maybe influence would be a better word, but somebody who has the capacity, in fact, to affect the lives of a great number of other people. And that's a huge responsibility and a gift.
And is that why so many companies today are prepared to give away material for free through social media or on YouTube, for example, as a way of promoting their business and their knowledge and their mission?
Yes, I think that's one of the motivations. I think also people sometimes are giving away information as bait, right? Because they want you to come in and buy something. That's fairly natural in a mercantile society.
And you're quite active in the ATEE. Why have you chosen that association to be particularly active in?
Honestly, I got drafted into it. The ATEE has what are called RDCs, Research and Development Communities, which are, as Ronnie Smet, who coordinates all of them, said this morning, they are the throbbing heart of ATEE, and I believe that to be true. And there was one, primary and pre-primary education, that had been dormant for a long time. And so we were called in as a team to try and revive it. And so we have been serving for the last 2 years as co-chairs of this RDC. We have 1 year left in our term. And I hope we will then turn it over to some other people who will take the reins and move ahead and probably do better than we have. But at least we've been able to stimulate a certain amount of interest and revive that into some sort of action and hopefully some common projects.
And what was it about your background that gave you the interest in education? Because your background is not conventional in the sense of working as a teacher or a teacher educator before being involved in the association.
I have always taught all during my career. I've done many, many things, but all along I have usually taught university or some other post-secondary type of institution. Or given professional level courses. I've done professional training. I've been in one division of IBM. I've been the coordinator for training for a whole sort of line of products and so on. So I've been developing instructional materials, educational materials all my life, all my career. Plus, I've worked as a journalist. And what is journalism? It's explaining things to people. Right, I've worked in the field of technical communication. That's about learning to use products, learning to use technology, learning to work in technological environments. And the discipline of technical communication now has gotten into very large questions of epistemology and knowledge management and how you organize knowledge and information. So it's a profession that started out as basically being, you know, the people that write those manuals that come with products that you always throw away without reading. That's what it used to be, but now we're into so many interesting things. It's a little bit like what's happened to the librarian profession. You know, we used to think of librarians as people who sat in stuffy corners, you know, with the smell of dust from old books all over them. Today, librarians are in the forefront of digital technology, and they know more than most of the rest of us about some of these questions I've been talking about, knowledge management, epistemology, and so on. And that's a bit what's been happening in some of the fields that I've been working in as well. So it's opened up this wonderful wide world, and it's just a great pleasure to share it with people.
And as someone who has made most of your career educating outside the formal sector, what are the challenges and what are the kinds of methods that you use in that kind of education?
Well, they're not so different from what's used in more formal educational settings. We rely a lot on what we learn from cognitive science. Some of the techniques, for example, for interviewing that we use in journalism are very similar to techniques that are used, especially in primary education, where, you know, you ask kids open questions and so on. And if we were switching positions, for example, and you gave me an answer, I might just repeat what you said to me and then look at you and wait, you know, and see what you give me back, that kind of thing. And these are ways of eliciting responses and also generating imagination and creativity. I was very surprised to learn when I attended a talk that was given by some family therapists that they use all the same techniques in interviewing their patients as we use as journalists interviewing various people. It might be politicians or people on the street or whatever. And of course, you change your technique depending on whether you're trying to get something out of someone that you think they might be withholding, or you want to be sympathetic and bring somebody into, you know, an informational environment, and so on. So you change your questioning methodology, the type of questions you pose, even the tone that you give. Another interesting thing about being a journalist is you change your costume. If you're going to interview a politician, you're not going to go in blue jeans. Well, today you might, actually, but traditionally you wouldn't have anyway. And you're not going to wear a suit and tie if you're going onto a factory floor to interview workers. And it's not a question of trying to be one of them, because you aren't and you never will fool them. It's just making yourself, from a visual point of view, not scary. Because having somebody stick a microphone in your face is already scary enough. And you don't want to have more than that.
The other thing that can be different about informal education is that the numbers can be different. So sometimes you might have one-to-one instruction, but sometimes you might have, you know, a lot of people you might be speaking to. So how have you handled that over the years?
One of the ways in which you have a lot of people is when you do webinars. And I did my first webinar after several years of being on the speaking circuit, and I treated it like being in a live presentation, and was very frustrated because I wasn't getting any visual feedback. And I was very, very uncomfortable. And actually, I did it quite badly, I have to say. Then I realized, you're using the wrong metaphor. It's like being on the radio. When you talk on the radio, you talk to millions of people potentially, and you don't see any of them, but you still know how to be personal with them. And so I adopted that for webinars, and it seemed to work. The other thing that I also enjoy in webinars is to make them as interactive as possible. You know, there's a chat box. So ask questions. Get them to respond in the chat box. Or a lot of webinar software has a polling feature that you can use. You get them to vote and so on. Or even get people actually discussing. And I've seen this, and I love it when we're talking about stuff in a webinar and you see in the chat box that the participants are debating amongst themselves about some point that you've raised or something. That's wonderful. I count that as being an extremely successful session when that happens. I taught a class, a technical subject, where every student had a computer. A group of 20 students. And I used to wander about the classroom, and I would look at what they had on their screens, and they could see me doing this. That didn't seem to bother them at all. Well, if they were Googling somebody or something that I had mentioned, then I was very happy. If they were booking concert tickets, or their next airplane trip, then I would think, I need to change something. You know, I need to readjust my presentation somehow.
The way you're describing that, it sounds to me like you're an educator who wants to keep on learning and is constantly learning. How do you go about learning to teach in the informal settings like you've described? Like, is there somebody who inspires you, or is there particular reading material that you consult, or how do you organize your own learning?
Well, it's all of the above. I've learned a lot of it just by instinct. You try something, you see if it works. When it does, you keep doing it until it doesn't. And I've also learned from other people's presentations. As I say, I attend a lot of conferences, so I see a lot of presentations, a lot of good ones and a lot of bad ones. And you learn a lot from both, things to avoid, things to do, things to change.
Who in particular do you find is good, or what have you found to be good?
I find the people who are really good are the people who are the most outrageous. People who will often deliberately shock you or make outrageous statements, but then back them up. You know, it's not good enough just to say something outrageous. You then have to be able to back it up with something. And I've learned that can actually be quite good. You know, you go out and say, classroom teaching is dead. But then you have to explain, what do you mean by that? Well, probably what you mean by that is standing up in front of a bunch of desks lined up in rows and columns, which is actually a model that was created for the 19th century Industrial Revolution, is obsolete. It doesn't mean that we don't work in classrooms and we don't have teachers anymore. It just means that the role of the teacher is changing, the way that the students work is changing, how the students interact with each other and with the material that they're learning is changing. And, you know, we're in the Google era. Google is your friend. So students don't need the teacher so much for subject matter. They can get that. But Google isn't going to teach them how to evaluate what they've found and to know whether they should trust it or not. Google is not going to help them integrate that material with other material that they've learned. It's not going to help them socialize the technology that they're working with or to learn when to turn it off and go play football or do something like that. You know, that's what teachers are there to help them with. Teachers become more of a guide. One of the things that I've actually run up against with teachers is teachers are afraid of technology, not because they're afraid of the technology itself, but they're afraid that the kids, especially young kids, will know more than they do. And my advice there is, cheer up. There's no hope. They always will know more than we do. You know, and that's great. Let them teach us about the technology. Let us guide them in how to use it well. And kids love to teach each other, and if they can teach an adult, wow. So be a good learner, you know. Don't be scared. You aren't losing control of your class if you let your students teach you something. Because you have something else to give them that they don't have. You know, and I often say, I do most of my teaching at post-secondary level or professional level, and very often what I say to them, and they never believe me, but I say it to them all the time, is the only difference between you and me, the only reason I'm the teacher is I've got a bigger bag of tricks than you do. You can make your bag of tricks bigger and you can teach.
And with those students that you're talking about, those who are post-secondary and professional, mm-hmm. Two things about them. First of all, they're adults and they may be more critical, but also they don't have as much time to waste. You know, you can't be wasting their time. So how do you go about getting feedback from them, and what is special about that aspect of teaching people who are busy and who are grown up?
One of the ways to do it is to ask them questions all the time, and not just questions, you know, of the type, now, what have we learned from this? It's more asking for their opinions, because they have them, and very often they'll give them even if you don't ask for it, so better you do. And they tell you very, very quickly, not always directly, but very quickly, you understand they're with you or they're not with you, or they're with you but don't like it. You just get it very, very easily. And as you say, they don't have a lot of time, and they will not come back if they think you're wasting it. I do online courses for working professionals, and part of what I try to do is keep in mind they have problems that they need to solve. And I ask them, you know, what are you concerned about? What's your problem in your job? You know, and how can I help you solve it? And sometimes it's very difficult, and sometimes you can't really solve it for them, but you can give them some avenues to look up, and then they go away satisfied because they've got some ideas that they didn't have before.
You've mentioned a few times that part of your earlier work was as a journalist, and I know that part of that involved making radio programs. So what goes into a good radio program?
First of all, knowing how to ask questions, and then also knowing how to put what you get together. I did a lot of documentary work, so I did fairly elaborated produced documentaries. And I would typically collect something like 10 hours of material for a one-hour documentary. Obviously, you end up with a lot of good stuff that you don't use, and sometimes it's really too bad. Sometimes you can actually make another program with some of that good stuff, and sometimes you can't. But the thing that you have to be thinking about all the time, again, it's the same thing you do in education. I'm a connectivist. And I really believe in connectivism. The great talent is making connections between things that don't necessarily seem obviously connected. What I'm thinking about when I'm doing an interview is, how am I going to link this with something else that I've already got? Because otherwise you can come up with 10 hours of bloody good stuff that you can't put together, because it doesn't make any sense putting it together. So you have to think about that. You have to think about, how am I connecting this stuff? The other thing that I always used to say at the time was, being a journalist means you have a garbage collector's mind. You're just constantly collecting all these little factoids, and they don't seem to have any relevance to anything until one day, one little factoid drops down, and it's the linchpin between all those other factoids. And then you go, aha, I've got a program, I've got a revelation, I've got something to tell the world, and you go out and do that.
But you need to be patient.
You do need to be patient, although not too patient, because usually it comes pretty quickly.
And is there a difference between a radio program, as you would have worked on them, and podcasts now?
Not a lot, honestly. The difference would be that a radio program comes in a continuity. That is, there's something that precedes it, and there's something that comes after. So you have to be conscious of where you sit in the programming day and what time of day you are broadcast in. You have a different tone or a pace if it's the evening or if it's the early morning, for example. Podcasts people listen to when they want, so you have no knowledge of that, and you have to be more sort of general in that sense. The other thing about podcasts is you can rewind. In a traditional radio, it only passes once. I got criticized by my producer when I was very young and just starting. He said to me, you work so hard on writing your scripts. He said, you pack so much information into them in order to save time. He said, it's really an art that you do. He said, but it's wrong. It's because the public can't absorb all that information. It only goes by once. And he was right, of course. And I had to learn how to unpack my scripts a little bit. There's an art to that as well.
I noticed, Ray, you're accent is North American, but on your badge it says France. So what is the connection?
I'm Canadian. I'm also American in the U.S. sense, because Canadian is also America. And I started, actually, when I was still working in radio, collaborating with European radio stations, and that's how I got interested in Europe, and eventually decided I'd rather live in Europe than in North America. So I made the move now a good 26 years ago. And I've been living in France and in recent years also in Spain because of family connections. And so I live across the border in the south of France and the north of Spain, and have quite a nice life, actually. But also, I've almost forgotten when people ask me this question, that also my original reason for coming to France in particular was to do new technology. And at the time, everybody in France said to me, are you nuts? You're leaving North America where you're all ahead of everybody and coming here where we're so far behind? And I said, absolutely, and there's a real reason for it. And that is that France, and now I'm talking about, I came in the early 90s. At that time, well, France had and still has this incredible history of culture built around the written word, the whole intellectual tradition in France, which is really based on the written word. At the same time, the French government had been investing enormous amounts of money in digital technology and especially telecommunications. France was known for having a telephone system that didn't work in the rain. So they tore it out completely and replaced it all with fiber optic very, very early in terms of the trunk lines, you know, the main backbone and so on, and went almost overnight from having a system that didn't work in the rain to having the most advanced system in Europe. And a lot of that technology, which various governments of whatever political color were encouraging, was and is a technology largely based around images, and which in some ways is anathema to the written word. And I was very interested in being on the front where those two ideas confront each other. Because what I thought was, since the internet at that time was just beginning to be generalized outside of academic institutions, that was a model that could produce something much more interesting and creative than the sort of all commercial model that the US people were promoting at the time.
What from your own education inspires you or influences your thinking about education today?
I would say the teachers that I had. I was very, very lucky. I was educated in a public high school in the United States, and it was only many years later that I recognized just how wonderful and exceptional that public high school was and how good my teachers were. And they were really an exceptional collection. I learned later that the school I went to was considered one of the top five public high schools in the United States. So I was privileged in that regard. And the privilege of having such good teachers made me very conscious of what a good education meant, and especially the background that it gave me going into university and beyond.
And finally, who or what inspires you?
In general?
And professionally, but in general, yeah.
People who are better at it than I am, who have insights that I think, gee, I should have seen that. Why didn't I? That inspires me. When people start talking about certain subjects or I start reading certain books, I get this, I don't know, it's this, I have to use a French word, frémissement, this sort of effervescence going on inside. I just get so excited about it. Sometimes I get so excited I can't go on reading. Those kind of things, that inspires me. The synergy of collaborating with really smart people and having something come out that's greater than the sum of its parts, that really inspires me. Those are the things that keep me going. I'm actually a fairly old guy at this point, but I don't feel it, and I don't feel it because I get to do that. That really just keeps me going, and I love it.
And that was Ray Gallen from the Transformation Society, bringing this week's Inside Education to a close. Thanks to Ray for his time in recording the interview. To listen back to this program or over 300 previous episodes, you can log on to seandelaney.com/podcasts. My own book about teaching, Become the Primary Teacher Everyone Wants to Have, which is published by Routledge, can be ordered at your local library or purchased from most online bookstores. I hope you can join me at the same time next week for more on Inside Education. For now, from me, Sean Delaney, it's goodbye. Thank you for listening.